Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy, committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Why did you decide to write a history of Scientology?
Well, I have two main interests in the study of religion. One is the role of secrecy in religion. Much of my research since graduate school has been on the role that secrecy and concealment play in different religious traditions. That is why some groups choose to keep aspects of their beliefs and practices close to outsiders. And then what are the larger social, cultural, and political impact of that secrecy? And Scientology, because it has such a long history of both secrecy within its own beliefs and then complex relations of secrecy and surveillance concealment with various aspects of the government and the media, seemed like a perfect test case for that sort of study. And the second reason is that I'm a historian of religions. That is, I'm interested in the ways in which religions come to be and grow and change over time, and also in the way in which our very category and understanding of religion changes over time. And Scientology, because it emerges in the sort of very tumultuous years after World War II, with the rise of many new religious movements, is a really ideal case for thinking about both how religions come to be and then how controversial movements change our very understanding of what religion is.
We should talk about the founder of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, because there is a lot of mystery surrounding this man. You describe him as a bricoleur. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. What I mean by that, that's a term that comes from the anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, and he uses that to talk about the ways in which religious individuals pick and choose different pieces of many different things and put them together in interesting new ways. And I found that a really useful way to think about Hubbard, because he himself says that in the course of coming up with the idea of Dianetics and Scientology, that he explored everything. He explored automatic writing and clairvoyance and various chemicals, everything under the sun, in order to come up with his new science of how the mind works. And as he develops Dianetics, he's really incorporating many, many different things. There are elements of psychoanalysis, sort of popular therapy and self-help that was just getting going in the early 1950s. He eventually brings in elements of Eastern religions like Hinduism and Buddhism and puts it all together in this fairly remarkable new synthesis that became incredibly successful and popular in the early 1950s and then took off in the 1960s.
And before Hubbard created Scientology, he developed what he called a new science of the mind, which is what he called Dianetics. What was the basic premise here?
Well, the term Dianetics he used, taking it from the Greek dia and nous, meaning through the mind. And the idea of Dianetics is that all of our problems come through the mind, and therefore all the solutions come through the mind as well. Hubbard believed that he had understood how the mind really works, and he divided the mind into two basic parts: the reactive mind, which is very similar to the psychoanalytic idea of the unconscious, which is a repository of negative experiences that we have throughout our life. Moments of pain and unconsciousness become burned in the reactive mind in the form of what Hubbard called engrams, which are negative memory traces that then cause us problems in the future, both physical problems and psychological problems. The other part of the mind he called the analytical mind, which works like a flawless computer and sees the world accurately. And so the process of Dianetics involves going back and identifying where these negative memory traces lie, a process that he called auditing. And once you have identified and talked through these negative memory experiences, then they're cleared from your reactive mind. And eventually, once all of those experiences have been removed, you achieve the state called clear, which he described as an optimum state of psychological and physical well-being.
So there really is a lot of crossover with psychoanalysis here. I mean, the idea is that you have to go back deep into your mind, dig out the unpleasant stuff and somehow purge it, and then you can get to clear thinking.
There is a great deal of overlap, and when Dianetics first comes out, it was initially described by the media as a kind of poor man's psychoanalysis that was doing many of the same things, but something that could be practiced by anyone who simply read the book Dianetics. On the other hand, though, Hubbard was very critical of psychoanalysis for several reasons. First, he thought that it was much too focused on sex. And second, he thought that psychoanalysis at the time was simply treating people with drugs and shock therapy and things like that. So he imagined Dianetics as a more humane and also, he believed, a more accurate way of getting at negative experiences and purging them.
So when he started talking about Dianetics, did this movement gain much traction among people?
It did. It was a surprising success to everyone, including Hubbard himself. The book Dianetics, when it was published in 1950, went to the top of the New York Times bestseller list and remained there for 28 weeks. The movement really took off like wildfire across the U.S. It was really the first major popular form of self-help at the time. And there were, you know, small Dianetics clubs that popped up all over the country. The success of Dianetics did not last very long, only a year or so, before the movement actually went bankrupt. And it was at that point that Dianetics in its early form sort of fizzled. And shortly after that, Scientology takes its place.
Why would Dianetics go bankrupt if it was so popular?
Well, part of it is that it was a decentralized movement. That is, anyone could read the book and start forming little Dianetics clubs around the country. So it was becoming very popular by word of mouth, but the revenue wasn't necessarily coming back to Hubbard himself. There are also disputes within the early Dianetics community between Dianetics and some of his early supporters who felt that he was increasingly authoritarian and that he was also pushing Dianetics in a direction that was increasingly unscientific. Initially, Dianetics was presented as a science of the mind, but very quickly he began exploring things that seemed to some supporters as non-scientific, such as past life experiences, reincarnation, and things like that.
So what is the difference then between Dianetics and Scientology? Because he basically moved from Dianetics to establish the Church of Scientology.
That's right. So Dianetics lasts for about a year or so, and then pretty much fizzles by 1952, 1953. And out of the sort of the ashes of early Dianetics emerges the Church of Scientology. So one of the key differences is that Dianetics is focused primarily on this lifetime and examining, talking through, and clearing the engrams from this lifetime. Very quickly, people who are practicing Dianetics began to believe that they were recalling past life experiences as well. And that's when Hubbard developed the idea of what he calls the Thetan, which is our spiritual self, which is eternal and lasts beyond this particular body. And he began developing elaborate ideas of past life experiences, some going back billions and trillions of years. So Scientology introduced a spiritual dimension that was not there in Dianetics. Well, that's one reason for the emergence of Scientology. Another is that Dianetics practitioners began to be investigated by the FDA and by different medical boards. Several practitioners of Dianetics in the 1950s were arrested for practicing medicine without a license. And so part of the reason for the shift from Dianetics to Scientology was a shift in the spiritual direction, so that if they're practicing a spiritual therapy and not making claims to physical healing, they're no longer under the scrutiny of the FDA and medical boards.
Now, one thing that we should also point out is that L. Ron Hubbard wrote science fiction stories. In fact, that's what he did before he founded this whole Dianetics movement, before he turned to Scientology. And you can see those science fiction influences in some of his later thinking, can't you?
That's right. So Hubbard was really one of the most prolific, if not the most prolific, author of science fiction in the golden age of science fiction in the 1930s and 40s. He wrote literally hundreds and hundreds of stories, not just science fiction, but also westerns, fantasy tales, things that dealt with the supernatural and the occult. And Dianetics, as a science of the mind, was actually a fairly earthbound departure from that science fiction material. But when he found the Church of Scientology in 1953 and 1954, a lot of the science fiction elements reemerge. So when he starts talking about past lives, he often talks about past lives, not just on this Earth, but on other planets, things like repairing the engines of a spaceship underwater 3 trillion years ago and things like that, and eventually develops what he called a history of the whole time track, that is, the history of the universe going back millions and trillions of years, with fairly elaborate cases of what he calls space opera, or elaborate tales of life on other planets and different invader forces that had come to this Earth, and so on and so forth.
Wait, so he's saying that this cosmology goes back millions and even trillions of years. I mean, it's one thing to say that in a science fiction book, but then to say that is the basis of a new religion, I mean, that's out there, isn't it?
Well, it seems out there now, but part of my argument is that if you put Scientology in its context, in 1950s and 60s America, it seems much less out there. For example, if you look at what else was on the New York Times bestseller list when Dianetics is at the top, it's also other popular self-help books like Norman Vincent Peale's The Art of Happiness and a book called The Truth About UFOs. So this is a period when there's a lot of interest in UFOs, space travel. It's also a time when Eastern religions are starting to enter the United States, which bring along with them interest in reincarnation. So it seems out there in 2012, perhaps, but if you put it in the context of what else was going on in Cold War America following World War II, it seems actually fairly cutting edge, perhaps.
But then you get into some of the stories in this sort of science fiction, well, maybe I shouldn't use that word, in this this whole metaphysical view. I mean, there's a story involving the Galactic Confederacy. Tell me about that. Tell me about the history here.
Well, the story about the Galactic Confederacy is the one that most Americans probably know from the cartoon satire South Park, which presented the whole story in one of its episodes. This story centers around a figure called Xenu, who was the head of the Galactic Confederacy 75 million years ago. And this story is part of one particular higher level of training called Operating Thetan Level 3. It's a little bit difficult to deal with because it's a level of training that's only supposed to be known to Scientologists who have attained that level and gone through the proper auditing levels before that. But the story was leaked through a couple of court cases, and the entire transcript of this story became part of the court record and then leaked to the internet. So now it's really all over the place, including on South Park. But it's an elaborate story that purports to explain the sort of situation that human beings are in and where our problems come from. And the story, at least as it was leaked through the court cases, is that the intergalactic emperor Xenu was trying to solve the problem of overpopulation in his sector of the universe. And so he took a number of beings and put them on planet Earth, which was then called planet Tegeac. Then he planted atomic bombs in the volcanoes of planet Tegeac, blew them up, and the souls of those individuals who were blown up were caught in giant soul catchers and were sort of brainwashed and then were confused and glommed onto early human beings. And we all have these extra body spirits or extra body thetans attached to us, sort of like spiritual barnacles, I guess you could say. So the advanced levels of training involve removing these extra body thetans from us so that we can clear the negative effects that they've brought with us.
Kind of a remarkable story, isn't it? You're saying that's not out there?
It seems out there now, but this story was first developed in the late 1960s when there was a lot of interest in these science fiction elements and in reincarnation and space travel. So it may seem out there to us, but it seems less out there in the context of the late 1960s. And also, I think this is a narrative that was to be only revealed to those who had gone through the most sort of hardcore training. So it wasn't for the run-of-the-mill Scientologists. This is for the elite few who've gone through all of the preparatory levels and are ready for these more secret documents.
So what kind of people did Scientology attract?
Well, initially, I think it really covered a broad spectrum of the American populace. In the early days, many were those who were science fiction enthusiasts, those who were interested in Eastern religions. For example, I interviewed a fellow named Jim Dinkalsi, who had been L. Ron Hubbard's physician in the 1970s for about 10 years. And he was interested in Scientology for many reasons. One, he was getting interested in Eastern religions and the idea of reincarnation. Second, he was really disgusted with the state of psychoanalysis at that time and was looking for a way to deal with the mind in a way that was, in his view, more humane. So these are, you know, not crazy people. They're not losers or outsiders. Mainstream Americans who were interested in a different perspective on things and found a lot of the answers they were seeking in Scientology.
Now, certainly one of the remarkable things about this whole story is, I mean, you're talking about the creation of a new religion in the middle of the 20th century. We tend to think of religions as the kinds of things that go back hundreds, if not thousands of years. And yet here's someone who comes along and lays out this whole new way of thinking and then finds people who follow him, who join his religion. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it?
It is an amazing test case because it gives you sort of a window onto the birth and growth of religion, which is fairly rare. We can't go back 2,000 years ago and see the birth of Christianity or any other religions, but we can see that in the case of Scientology. And the interesting thing about Scientology to me is that Hubbard didn't really start out to create a religion. There are stories that he joked with other science fiction writers that the only way to make money is to start a religion. But it doesn't seem that that's really what he started out to do. Dianetics really had nothing religious about it. He actually, in his early writings of the early 50s, was pretty critical of mainstream religion, particularly Christianity. And it's really only because of several of things that we've already talked about that happened in the early 50s. One, the scrutiny he was getting from the FDA and medical boards. Second, the pursuit of past life experiences that were coming up during Dianetics auditing. And then the third thing that led him to pursue what he called the religion angle was the fight they had with the IRS that begins in the 1950s and really blows up in the 1960s and leads to a 25-year war with the IRS from about 1967 until 1993.
Why was Hubbard fighting with the IRS?
Well, when Scientology emerges in 1953, 1954, and begins to pursue what Hubbard called the religion angle, initially they had no real trouble getting tax exemption from the IRS. The churches in Washington, D.C. and in California were initially granted tax exemption with little effort. But pretty quickly, by about 1958, the IRS began to look at them more carefully and determined, in their view, that the profits were really going to Hubbard and his family and that it was really a for-profit business and not a charitable organization or a religious entity. In the 1960s, Hubbard shifted all of the Scientology assets to the Church of Scientology of California, which had sort of flown under the IRS radar and still had tax exemption. And then in 1967, the IRS strips that too. In 1969, then Scientology files a lawsuit with the IRS, and that leads to a massive war for the next 2.5 decades. And it's during that time, particularly in the 1970s, that Scientology really starts emphasizing the outward display of religious trappings, such as auditors wearing clerical collars, prominently displaying the Scientology cross in Scientology centers, making use of the Scientology creed, etc. So really playing up their similarity to more recognizable American religions, particularly Christianity.
And then how did the dispute with the IRS finally get resolved?
Well, that's still a bit of a mystery. In 1991, the then head of the Church of Scientology, David Miscavige, and one of his top lieutenants, Marty Rathbun, went and met with the head of the IRS, and they reached some kind of agreement, the details of which are still rather murky to me, at least, that led to, in 1993, the IRS giving a really blanket exemption to all Scientology entities across the board, which is pretty remarkable because that exemption includes not just churches of Scientology, but also many of Scientology's branches and entities that are not necessarily religious, like the publisher of L. Ron Hubbard's science fiction, also falls under that tax exemption. So a fairly remarkable sort of blanket exemption.
Now, the other thing that you say about the founding of Scientology is this is very much a religion that came into being during the Cold War. It was, to some degree, a product of that era of anti-communism. Can you explain this?
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting parts of the development of Scientology to me. And so I really spent a good chunk of the book looking at that piece of the puzzle, Scientology's growth and development during the Cold War. And I made that argument for a couple of reasons. One, Hubbard himself presented Dianetics and Scientology really as the solution to nuclear war. Like others, he believed that the human race was probably going to destroy itself by nuclear war unless we learned how to control ourselves, as it were. So in promoting Dianetics and Scientology, he really presented it as the solution to the atomic bomb. Secondly, he was really concerned with communism throughout his writings. In the early 1950s, he wrote numerous letters to the FBI and to J. Edgar Hoover himself, identifying communist threats both externally and within his own organization. And third, I argued that the preoccupation that Scientology had with secrecy and security and information control is really a microcosm of the larger Cold War American concern with secrecy and information control. So not only did Scientology develop its own highly classified upper levels of training, like the OT3 levels, But it also developed its own sort of intelligence office, the Guardian's office, which was concerned with sort of policing the flow of information within and without the Church of Scientology, and eventually became involved in really remarkable, elaborate espionage and counter-espionage with the IRS and other U.S. government offices.
We should talk about some of these more secretive practices. I mean, certainly one of the most controversial ones is what you've just mentioned, the what's called the OT3, the Operating Thetan 3, which I guess only advanced practitioners of Scientology get into. What is this?
So OT stands for Operating Thetan, and these are upper levels of Scientology auditing that go beyond the state of clear. So once you've achieved the state of clear, which you've cleared all your negative memory traces from this lifetime, then you enter these more advanced levels. The term or phrase operating thetan means a thetan or spiritual entity that's become more and more independent or free of the material world and eventually is claimed to have various supernatural abilities. So in the Scientology map, or what's called the Bridge to Total Freedom, there are listed 15 of these operating thetan levels. Hubbard only appears to have completed 8 of them before his death. The most controversial one is this third one, operating thetan level 3, which is the one that reveals the story about Emperor Xenu and the past history of planet Earth and extra body thetans and all of that.
I guess I'm unclear. Why do you have to have this advanced level of practice before you would hear about this foundational story about the Emperor Xenu?
Well, according to Scientology literature and Hubbard's own statements, it would be dangerous for individuals who weren't prepared to have this information revealed to them. It could do psychological or even physical harm. He called operating thetan level 3 the wall of fire. That was very difficult for him to break through and understand. And so individuals who didn't have the correct training just wouldn't be able to handle it, in the same way that if you didn't have the correct training to go rock climbing on a steep cliff face, you would be in danger.
So you need the correct psychological training, the correct spiritual training, I guess.
Correct.
Why all the secrecy, though? I mean, why not just put all this out in the open and let people practice as they want?
Well, that's a real interesting, difficult, and controversial question. Cynics, of course, would say that the secrecy is there to protect its value. The operating thetan levels become quite expensive. To get to operating level 8, operating thetan level 8, it's been estimated that one would have to pay between $300,000
and $400,000. $400,000? Who are you paying this to?
Well, they're listed as donations to the Church of Scientology, but they are set donations.
For what? I mean, what do you get for paying all that money?
The knowledge and training that one acquires through going through the auditing levels that accompany each of these operating thetan levels. And along with that, the increased freedom and independence of the thetan from the material world, and purportedly one also has supernatural abilities. One of the things that Hubbard claimed was that a thetan who becomes increasingly independent can exteriorize or leave the body, can become clairvoyant. If you read accounts of Scientologists in many of Scientology publications, such as Advance Magazine, they claim all sorts of supernatural abilities from having gone through the operating thetan levels. Everything from being able to fix broken appliances to healing their pet cat to exteriorizing from the body and flying around the universe.
So you are a historian of religion. You've looked at the histories of a lot of different religions. How do you look at this history and the stories that you hear about Scientology?
Many aspects of Scientology seem pretty out there to most Americans when they first encounter them. But if you think about it, many aspects of many religions seem pretty out there to those who don't grow up in those traditions. So if you told someone who'd never heard of Christianity the story of the Garden of Eden, and that there was a talking snake and there was a tree with an apple and then they got kicked out of the garden, someone who had never encountered that story before would find that pretty strange. In the same way that someone who's never encountered Hindu mythology finds the stories about Shiva and Krishna and Kali and Durga quite bizarre, or someone who's never encountered Native American spirituality or African religions. So in that context, in the broader history of the kinds of narratives that human beings have come up with to explain the universe, the story about intergalactic Emperor Xenu really isn't that out there. I think it seems out there to most Americans because of the science fiction elements, knowing that Hubbard was a science fiction author, the fact that it's a new religion. When we think of ourselves as scientific and modern and rational, to have a story with this many unusual science fiction elements probably strikes most Americans as more bizarre than a Hindu myth written 2,000 years ago.
Well, I want to come back to the question of secrecy because, of course, the charge that critics make is that the Church of Scientology is a cult. And there are, I mean, the secrecy is to sort of keep the followers who've bought into the cult separated from the outside world and to sort of wall off the outside world. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, that's a common criticism for sure. From the very beginning, when Dianetics emerges, it was often labeled as a cult. And it gets going really in the 60s and 70s at a time when we have many new religions emerging in the United States and increasing concerns about cults and brainwashing and all of that. Personally, I follow the lead of other American scholars of religion who don't really think that the term cult is very useful, mainly because it's so laden with negative connotations that when you hear the word cult, you immediately think of sacrificing babies to Satan and all that sort of thing. Most scholars in the U.S. like the phrase new religious movements because it's more neutral rather than cult, which is so inherently pejorative, at least these days, the way it's usually used. That being said, calling something a new religious movement or a religion does not mean that you can't say anything critical about it. So we can still look very closely at Scientology's history of unethical, at times illegal behavior. We can look closely at the practice of secrecy and what that's about without necessarily dismissing it as a cult.
Well, there is also the question of whether Scientology actually is a religion. Although you say in your book that you think that's the wrong question to ask, and the right question is who gets to define religion?
Yeah. So what I argued in the book is that our definition of religion is always changing. So, for example, in the mid-19th century, when Mormonism comes along, Mormonism was also considered crazy and a cult, and Joseph Smith and his followers were chased halfway across the country. These days, however, Mormonism is one of the largest denominations in the world. Some consider it an independent world religion in its own right with millions and millions of followers. So how we understand religion is always changing. And the period after World War II was a period in which it was changing very quickly as we have new imports coming from the East and all sorts of new religions emerging in the United States. So I thought it was more interesting to think about how religion gets defined and who gets to define it. And it's really not a question of a few academics like me writing away in universities defining religion. Rather, it involves a whole number of different agents, including not just scholars, but also the religious practitioners. It involves courts, it involves lawyers, it involves government agencies like the IRS and the FDA, the State Department, et cetera, the media, journalists, et cetera. So it's really a much more complex conversation and debate that is always evolving and changing over time. So to me, that's a more interesting way of thinking about it than simply saying it is or isn't a religion, because 20 years from now, we'll probably be thinking about religion differently than we are right now.
Hmm. Well, we should say that the Church of Scientology itself has said that it is the world's fastest growing religion. Do you know how many people actually belong to the church?
Well, that's a really difficult question because the church's numbers are in the millions. It claims members in every country in the world. But most of the surveys that I've seen suggest that that's really quite an exaggeration. All of the surveys that I've seen in the last few years suggest not only that its numbers are much smaller than that, but are actually declining. There was a survey a couple of years ago that found that its numbers had really dropped almost in half in the last couple of decades in the United States, and that trend seems to be going on in England and other parts of the world as well. So it's difficult to gauge exactly how many Scientologists there are. It's probably not in the millions. It's probably more in the tens of thousands, at least in the United States. And by current trends, it seems to be waning rather than increasing.
Well, there also is a fight going over the reputation of Scientology, and a lot of it is playing out on the internet. And this sort of decentralized collective of hackers known as Anonymous has taken on the Scientologists. So what's the nature of the dispute there?
Well, it's interesting that not long after Scientology won tax exemption from the IRS in 1993, it was immersed in a whole new war on the internet. And a lot of it was precisely over the leaking of the esoteric Operating Thetan materials that first came out in a couple of court cases in the 1990s and then very quickly went to the internet, which was starting to explode in the 1990s. And the very nature of the internet, of course, is that it's very difficult to staunch the flow of information because the internet always finds a way around. The Anonymous group got involved a bit later in 2008 when a video made by Tom Cruise, which was a confidential video for Scientologists, kind of promotional video to generate enthusiasm about Scientology, was leaked to YouTube. And in the video, Tom Cruise does seem particularly intense, I guess is the best way to put it. So it was rather embarrassing for Cruise and for Scientology. And Scientology and the Cruise folks demanded it be taken down from YouTube. It was. And at that point, the Anonymous Collective became involved. Anonymous takes on many different causes. And it took on this one in particular because one of the things that they really agree upon, even though they're a very diverse, decentralized network, is the free flow of information online. And they saw this as a real threat to the free flow of information, and they saw Scientology as really the poster child of the sort of authoritarian business that they're most opposed to. And so they began launching a campaign both online by sending out videos, also disseminating the esoteric Scientology materials worldwide through the internet.
So they were basically trying to find the stuff that was considered secretive and to post it on the internet.
The operating Thetan levels, which are confidential, but then everything else. One anonymous member that I met with has had a huge, huge archive of everything you can think of. I was stunned at the amount of data he had on his laptop. everything I'd ever heard of, and many things I'd never heard of, he had all on his hard drive. So they're data collectors and they're data sharers. And so any time a movement, particularly one like Scientology, tries to shut down the flow of information, they take that as a kind of rallying cry.
Now, one thing I've always heard about the Church of Scientology is that it can be quite litigious. And for those critics who say negative things, you better be prepared to back it up. Have you run into problems since your book came out?
I haven't personally. It's true that Scientology is arguably the most litigious new religious movement, at least in the United States, and has launched thousands of lawsuits against the IRS and other government agencies, launched lawsuits against folks spreading information on the internet. The individual I mentioned who collected the huge amount of Scientology data, he was actually an ordinary college student who had just put up some things on Scientology on his personal website. He was threatened by Scientology lawyers, and he had his internet service terminated, his email terminated. So they do have a very intense history of litigation at almost every level. But that strategy seems to have changed in the last decade. Scientology lost a huge lawsuit with Time magazine after Time had done a very scathing expose called The Cult of Greed in 1991. Scientology launched a massive lawsuit against Time and lost. And it seems that since then, because that was such a loss in terms of both money and sort of reputation, they've backed off of their more aggressive litigation and really haven't done too much in the last decade. For example, when South Park did its parody of the Xenu story, Scientology really didn't do anything to South Park. A couple of years ago, the St. Petersburg Times did a huge expose on Scientology and the alleged violence and abuse of the current head, David Miscavige, and Scientology really didn't go after them. So it seems that they've shifted gears and are no longer pursuing that sort of intense litigation in the same way that they had been. So I haven't personally had any problems.
How has the Church of Scientology responded to your book? Not in terms of, you know, threatening lawsuits or not, but just as an academic history of the church?
Well, an early review of the book came out in the Village Voice the summer after I finished it, and I got a phone call almost immediately from the head of the Scientology Public Affairs Office in Hollywood, and we had a long conversation about it. And I explained that the book is not an expose. It's not out to reveal any dark secrets of Scientology. It's really just a straightforward history of the church and its complicated role in American culture over the last 50 years. And so, of course, they disagreed with many aspects of my narrative of the story of Scientology, but we seem to have a polite, respectful understanding that this is my take on it. I'm not doing an expose. I'm not revealing any confidential materials. So I didn't really have any negative interaction with them. I mean, obviously they had disagreements, but we had a polite understanding about it.
So what do you think is the future of the Church of Scientology?
Well, I think right now they're really in a bit of a crisis. A number of very high-level Scientologists have left in the last few years. Marty Rathbun, Mark Rinder, who are two of the top Scientologists, left a few years ago. And particularly now that it's so easy to self-publish books, there have been probably a dozen accounts by ex-Scientologists that have come out. Nancy Menny's book, Mark Headley's book, there's been about a dozen or so quite damning accounts. And then Janet Reitman's book, Inside Scientology. So they're facing a number of problems. Many members leaving, all these exposés coming out, these new exposés from media sources like the St. Petersburg Times, which are indicating that there may be real abuse and violence going on. And it does seem that their numbers are declining. They still have quite a large war chest, so I've been told by people who've left the movement recently. So they're still quite wealthy, and they're currently building a number of what are called ideal orgs around the world, often in historic buildings that they're buying up. So in terms of their revenue and their finances, they're doing well. But in terms of their numbers, they do seem to be declining. And I think unless they really shift gears pretty quickly and especially give up trying to fight these really pointless wars on the internet, I think they may be in trouble. Some ex-Scientologists like Marty Rathbun have called for a kind of reformation of Scientology. He's still a believer in Hubbard's teachings and in Scientology, but believes that the current leadership has simply gone awry. And so there is a kind of call for some sort of reformulation or reformation of Scientology in some quarters, which may be what's needed, I don't know. But it does seem that unless something changes in their current strategy of dealing with both the media and with current members, that they may be in trouble in the near future.
Well, I can't let you go without asking about Tom Cruise for a moment. How important is he to the identity of Scientology or the future of this church?
Well, I think Tom Cruise is really a mixed blessing for Scientology. On the one hand, his fame and celebrity and status really have been a great boon, and they've used him to their advantage, like the promotional video in 2008, both to generate support among existing members and to try to attract new folks. But on the other hand, Tom Cruise is such a loose cannon and has such a negative reputation for many people also that he's probably been as much a liability as an asset to the Church of Scientology. That's sort of my take on it.
Okay. Fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope we got through most of your questions adequately.
Yes. Well, it's such a complicated story. We could go on for longer, but we don't have that time. So anyway, that was great. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Good. Thanks. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.